I should check before.
No light came on.
Hello. Hello.
Yeah. I think probably you can turn on the volume. I have to more close to you.
Okay. Okay, now you can hear. Okay. All right, let's start at the college. Sometimes when I have only a few students come to class, I will say, it's okay. All the students who are getting an A are here today. So then they go back and tell their friends. He said that all the students that got an A were at class today. So then when their friends come, I say, it's okay. I still have some B's left. This month will be the A's. Next month, we will still have room for some B's. Let's begin with prayer. Dear God, I thank you for the students that you give to us as teachers, the young lives that are in our classes will live for eternity. Help us to remember that when we teach, that whatever the subject is that we're teaching, whatever assignment we have been given, the souls of our students are eternal. Help us to love them the way you love them. Help us to care for them like you care for them. And help us to train them to be what you want them to be. I pray in Jesus' name. Amen. I was told that maybe class was smaller because I said there would be a test today. But the test is not difficult, so I don't think anyone should miss the test, but I don't know. I brought fewer notes this month than I have any other month because what I have been finding is I am hurrying to get through everything and leave you no time for discussion. And I really want us to have some time for discussion. So I have much fewer notes than I normally bring so that I would not be tempted to just talk and run out. So let me start. We have looked at three laws, and I would like to get your response of how you have been applying these three laws, and then I would like to have time for you to tell me any questions that you have up to this point about what we have talked about. We have talked about the law of expectations. That is, you must expect the best of every student because you will get what you expect. If you walk into the classroom feeling like this is a dumb class, they are not interested in the subject, they really don't want to learn, and they're not going to do anything, guess what they will do? They will be a dumb class who is not interested in the subject and won't do very much. I don't know if I have told you this before. If so, I apologize. I am old now. Someone told me last night after the concert, said, I enjoyed the concert, but you are really now too old to play on this. Made me feel very old. But I went to judge a piano contest a few years ago. And at the end of the contest, two of the teachers asked me to go with them to supper. And so I should have known there was a reason, but I said, okay. So we went to supper, and I did not know any of the teachers at the contest. I did not know any of the students. All I had done was listen and give a grade. Well, as we talked through the supper, I realized that their students, none of them had done well in the contest. And they were talking about another teacher who all of the good students went to that teacher. And they said, if we could get good students, we would be good teachers. We listened. And I was their guest, and so I wanted to be polite. I listened, and yes, yes, yes. Finally, they kept saying, so what should we do? What should we do? And finally, I said, my answer is going to make you very unhappy. And you just bought me a good supper. And so let's just leave now. I won't answer, and we will leave, and I will say thank you, and we will all be, no, no, we want your answer. I said, okay, I will tell you. You go to that teacher, and you get her to agree to swap students for 1 year. I will come back. I will still not know any students. I will listen again and grade. And the students that you are teaching now, that you give to her, in 1 year, they will win the competition. And her students that come to you will lose the competition. He said, no, that's impossible. That can't be. Why do you say that? And they were very unhappy. I told them they would be unhappy. The reason, that teacher expected a lot of her students. She required a lot. She poured a lot into them, and she required a lot from them, and they moved up. These two ladies that I was eating supper with, they grumbled about how bad their students were, how they didn't want to learn, they didn't want to do anything. And guess what? They got what they expected. The law of expectations. We have talked about the law of application, and that is our purpose as teachers is not just to put information into their heads. Our purpose as teachers is to change lives. And to do that, we have to touch their hearts. And that comes only from our heart. You cannot reach their hearts just from your head. You have to reach from your heart. And then we have talked about the law of retention. We retain facts when we understand them. And so to help them to understand them, we have to get them involved. And so as teachers, we have to be a coach who is letting them do the activity and we are guiding them rather than we doing all of the activity and they're just sitting watching. I know this third law, and I told it to you last week, but sometimes I forget it in my own teaching. And part of that is because my natural way of teaching is lecture. I like to get a lot of information and then start handing it out. So last 2 weeks, I have been teaching a section in Bible at the college. I gave a test last week, a week ago on Friday, and they did terrible. I've never had a class do as badly, the whole class, as this group. I mean, it was just, the grades were terrible. My pen was running out of red ink. I got done, I graded it on a Friday, and I looked at it, and I said, this is absolutely horrible. And I'm looking back, why did they not get it? And I'm looking at my notes. Yes, I told them that. Yes, I told them that. I told, what is wrong? And then I realized, I told them. So I went back to class, and I said, this won't work. I worked hard to teach this, and you didn't learn it, and I'm tired of working harder than you. So we're going to do the test again. I've never done a test twice over the same stuff. In 28 years of teaching, I've never gone back and done a test the second time. I said, but I'm going to do the test the second time, but this time, you're going to do all the work. I'm not going to give any lectures. All I'm going to do is stand here and ask questions. If you don't know it, you have to find it, because I'm not going to tell you a thing. And for a week, they did all the work. Friday, I gave them the test. And most of the average in the class was almost double the score of a week before. Why? Because instead of being this machine up there, talk, 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 they were doing the work they remember. The law of retention says, I've got to get them involved so that they understand it and then they remember it. So, of these laws, the test for you is simply, what have you learned and how have you been able to apply it in your teaching? Because as I told you the first day, if all you do is go home with lots of notes, it isn't going to make much difference. It is, how are you able to apply this in your teaching? So, who wants to volunteer to answer first? Who has applied at least one of these lessons some way in your teaching? Okay. Do we have a mic, maybe? Will that help? We want to hear your answer.
Yeah.
Okay. And remind me again, you are the small ones, okay?
So they washed it, and I was asked, in fact, I used one of the first ones regarding the broken window.
Okay.
Okay, so I said, how much love, why is it that even though the punishment, like we all are sinners, and how is it, in terms of taking our punishment, paying for our sins, how does that work? And I was trying to take back the remember you mentioned regarding the broken window. The broken window, how even though the child did not pay for the window, that the parents paid for it. And I said, in the same way, because of our sins, that Jesus paid for our sins. And they could understand that.
Okay.
They figured that out. And I said, even go a step further, what if your parents were so good, knowing that you're going to break all the windows all the time, that they paid over and above, like instead of $100 a window, they paid $1 million. That means every single time you break the window, it's already paid for. They could understand that. So I said, in the same way, we sin, and we sin a lot throughout our lives, and how Jesus has paid for it, and how relevant Easter is, and why it is Easter, why he had to die, and that was the payment for our sins.
Okay.
So they understood that. They relate to that. So, and asking them about, you know, why did Jesus do that? I said, why did your parent pay for that window? And he said, because my mama loves me, my parents love me. So they could equate that too. So they said, Jesus loves us, so he paid for our sins, just like our parents paid for the window because our parents cared and loved us. So that was, it was like you can almost see the light bulb goes in their little head.
Good, good, okay. It's important what she said with not just watching the video, but to connect it to their life. I think one of the things that has happened with teaching that is unfortunate is this. We begin to think that technology replaces teaching. Now, if I stand up here and lecture for an hour and the students are completely uninvolved, unengaged, will they learn? Not very much. If you replace me with a video, even a good video, and they're uninvolved, will they learn? No. And sometimes I have seen teachers that don't understand that, and they think as long as I bring in technology, whether it's a computer game or, you know, a video or whatever, if I do that, then magically teaching will happen. No, it still has to go to their heart. They still have to understand it and understand how it connects to their life. What is it that from this Bible lesson applies to my life? How does it relate to me? Very good example. Good, okay? Leah, I think...
Because Phil answered, I think I have an example, but that's fine. Yeah, because I missed the last week's last time, but I remember the one you talked about, the law of expectation,
okay.
Like exam, what do you do? I was not good at that, but that week I did try, you know, when I gave them some, you know, assignment, I tried to, you know, to check on them. It's not, I'm not like something, you know, I found it did help. You know, if you say I'm going to check, and then they will do that. But if you just say, I'm going to check, and then you don't check, and they know they can get away.
Yeah, good. All right.
I have a lot of practice. But I think it's a little hard, you know, on the teacher. Sometimes, you know, you do, and then you have her, you have other things come out. You just say, oh, I will check tomorrow, and tomorrow probably never come.
Mm-hmm. Teaching is hard work. And that kind of thing, it's easy just to let it go. And making sure the students know I will check it is important. I have been teaching an online class for a college. And each week they have assignments due, and I go through and I check them and I make comments and give them a grade. And one of the students emailed me and said, this is my 7th class, and it's the first time anyone ever actually read what I wrote. They just, yes, he did it, and give me, you know, a grade. They said, this is a little scary. Are you going to read everything I write? Somewhere along the line, they have had teachers who did not, they may have said, I expect it, but then they didn't follow up to see. And if we do that, students will become lazy. We're the same. If I know that no one's going to check, I'm not going to be as concerned about what I do as, you know, if the coming down here to teach, especially going home, I'm in a hurry to go home. If it says 70 miles per hour, but I know that they never check, yeah, I will go faster, right? If I know that they're checking, now I'm going to be more careful. What we expect, we have to inspect. All right, someone else.
I didn't have many opportunities to practice, but I did a little bit this morning we're going into the New Testament now. So I want to give them some tease questions to think about the different characters and different groups of people. So I asked them, Pharisees. We know who Pharisees are, but I asked them, what is Pharisee look like today? What does Pharisee look like today? So I tell them, look at me, myself. I am the Pharisee. If you want to know who Pharisee is, what they are, just look at me. So I make that application, and then they make the connection.
Good.
So I make it applicable and make it personal. And I sacrifice myself so that they will know that, yes, yes, Pharisee actually is someone that we always respect in the church. Mm-hmm. And then we have to be more careful and then to be more aware what we do and just make them think deeper.
Good, good. One of the things, and this will not apply so much to young children, they are probably not ready for this, but as, for instance, junior high, high school, certainly adults, one of the things that I think is very helpful is to make them think of the opposite side. Because sometimes all we do is we learn a set of answers and we repeat them back. And we don't understand that sometimes there are two ways of looking at something. And our way may not be wrong, but it is helpful to think about the other side. Let me give you an example. In my college class on wisdom books, we study the Song of Solomon. There are two ways that this book is usually interpreted. One is that it is an allegory that is a picture of God's love for us. Okay, and so all of the love language in the Song of Solomon is really a picture of God's love for us. The other way to read the book is that it is a set of love poems between a man and a woman, and that it's a picture of what God wants our relationship to be. Now, I always ask my class at the beginning, which do you believe? And so, you know, part of the class will say, at my college, it's usually most of them will say, no, it's an allegory. It's about God. And there will be some that will say, no, I think it's a love poem. There are good arguments for both. But most of them have never thought about the argument of the other side. And so I always give this assignment. I say, okay, in 2 weeks, we're going to have a debate. Everyone who believes that it is a love poem is required to argue that it is an allegory of God's love. And everyone who believes that it's an allegory is required to argue that it's a love poem. You have to bring the argument that is the opposite of what you think now. And then your grade will be how well you convince me of the position that you don't even agree with at this point. And my reason is I want them to think, is it possible that I'm wrong? Is it possible that the other side has something logical to say? Very often, here's what will happen when we're done. There will be some who will say, I listened to that side, but I still think that my original position was right. There will be others that will say, you know, once I read the other side, I realized I think they're right. I was wrong. That is learning when we actually begin to think about the possibility we could be wrong and we look at the other side. Now, I don't recommend that with little children because they're not yet ready to think through critically that level. But what you have done, in essence, is to say, okay, think of a Pharisee not as something far away, but something very close, and that forces us to think differently. All right, one more, and then we'll move on to look at a new law. I have one more volunteer for the test. So far, I've had 3 very good responses. No more volunteers. I really hate to pick people without volunteers. Do you have something you would like to say, sister? You look like you do.
I have been absent for 2 or 3 times maybe, because
Okay.
I'm minority in church. Have something, but I'm really feel the teacher when they have to give feedback from the students. If they don't involve, it's not about students being wrong. It's the teacher hasn't done the job, can't let them be involved in. So although, you know, I'm not being really say a good as a really teacher to you. I'm a leader for the children's songs.
Okay.
So this only for me is leading them to get into the sing the song, let them understand what they're singing.
Good.
So that before I sing any song, I will give them questions. I will input the song, the words of in song to the question,
mm-hmm.
and let them answer, and let them to think about it. And then when I sing, and then I will, you know, put them, let them to know ahead what that mean. And also, I also have them come to in front to sing together, especially those they are doing nothing. Okay. So give them a, sometimes is give them attention maybe, or sometimes, you know, try to let them, I look at them. I hope they can give me feedback.
Okay.
But I can feel someone, they don't want to look at you. They try to get away from your attention. But I see that, but sometimes I think, but when you look at them, they know you have attention on them.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember a big boy, he feel he's taller than others. He doesn't like to be like in the kids game. But when I always look at him, he start move in front. And then he start to really like to join a little bit. I think he's a little bit feel that he's not left behind. He's not be forgotten. And he, you know, they're shy, mostly boys. They don't like to sing. It seems like not there, you know. Now
sure.
Some things inside of them. But if you give them attention, I can feel they don't sing aloud, but they start moving, you know, their mouths.
Sure.
It seems like they try to, you know, take a little bit.
Okay.
So I think that's really things they need it.
Mm-hmm.
They need your expectation. If you don't give, he will just lay behind to say, oh, okay, they don't care about me, and I enjoy myself being doing nothing. But you give them a little bit, they will give you back, although you don't say anything. But
mm-hmm.
he can get from your eyes, maybe, and, you know, your body language. I think that's very important for them.
Good.
Yeah.
Good.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Yeah.
And that's good that you can do that without correcting them. It can just be very natural. That's important. Good. All right, any questions at this point of what we have talked about up to now? Over the last 3 months, are there any questions that you've had that you wish we would talk about? Okay, well then let me move on to what I want to look today. And I want to start, I asked you last time, is it true that you can take a horse to water, but you can't make him drink? And I said to you last time, that statement is not true. How do you make the horse drink? You put salt in his oats, and then the horse will very willingly drink. Now, that sounds maybe like a joke, but it really is not. Because here's what I find about teachers. Some teachers say, well, this horse doesn't want to drink, so I'm just going to let him die of thirst. And they just leave the horse alone, and, you know, the water is here, and if the horse wants it, the horse will come get water. Other teachers say, I'm going to make this horse drink, and they grab the horse's head and shove it under the water, and unless you're awful strong, that horse is going to kick you, and you're going to lose the battle. But a wise teacher doesn't have to force the horse to drink. A wise teacher is able to make the horse thirsty, and then the horse wants to drink. The horse says, ah, I've got to have some water. Then our job becomes much easier because they are looking for the answer. One of the things I like to do in a class, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't, but I like in a class to finish a class with a question that kind of leaves them wondering, what's going to come next? Because then they're through the week, they're thinking about this question. Why did he say that? Why did he ask that? To prepare them for what you're going to teach. What are you doing? You are making them thirsty. Now, as I was thinking about that this week, I realized there is something that has to happen before that. And so I want to give you a brief little test. This is for you to take. I'm not going to ask for your results. But just, you have the questions there. Take a pencil and mark real quickly from 0 to 3. I think about my students outside of class. Between classes, I find myself thinking about students, what they are doing, how can I help them? Is that something that, yes, you do a lot, maybe some? No, you probably don't think about your students at all. Or zero means when I leave that class, I don't want to even know their names until next week. Then put a check mark in the column, I often wish class was longer. When you finish the class, I wish I had another hour. Or, yeah, usually I could use more time. Or, no, I'm done. Or, I wish we could have Sunday school just for 5 minutes every third week. Strongly disagree. The third one, I look forward to learning more about the subject on my own. I'm still trying to grow. If you are a person who goes home and you're excited to study the lesson, give yourself a 3. If you find that, yeah, you usually are wanting to learn, 2. No. And if you're a person who says, I hate what I am teaching and I don't want to do it at all, that's a 0. My students tell me that I excite them about this subject. I teach freshman Bible at the college. And I do it by choice. About 15 years ago, the dean called me and asked me if I would teach the senior Bible classes. And I said, yes, I will be happy to. But I also want to teach the freshmen. And he said, no, nobody wants to teach the freshmen. Why do you want to teach the freshmen? They don't want to even come to Bible class. I said, I really want to teach the freshmen. So they agreed that I could teach the freshmen, although the dean could not figure out why. But the reason is this. The first day there will be 30 students, 40 students, and I will ask them some questions, and here's what I find. Out of the 40, there will be 10 who really want to know more about the Bible. They're excited. I know the first day. What grade are they going to get?
A.
And it really doesn't matter if I'm a good teacher or not, because they're going to study it anyway. They want to learn. They'll get an A, and it doesn't mean a thing about my teaching. It's just because they wanted to learn. There will be 20 who came to college because I'm out of high school and, you know, it's either come to college or get a job, and they look at me and say, yeah, if you can teach me, that's fine. You know, if you don't, that's also fine. My goal is I want them to be excited. And then there will be usually 5 or 6 who say, try to teach me. I didn't want to come here, but it was either here or prison. Not quite, but just try to make me learn. And I find for me the challenge is, can I get that group of students to leave freshman Bible excited about learning the Bible? That's our goal as teachers, to excite our students. So, do you find that you excite your students about your subject? Do you talk with students outside of class? Or are you like, especially college teachers, who walk in exactly at the time for class to start with their big binder and say, okay, it's time to start class, start writing, and when the bell rings, goodbye, I'll see you next week. Do you talk to your students? Do you tell others about your class? Do you find for most of us we talk about what we're excited about? Would you agree? I have a friend who loves to go on cruises. He and his wife love cruises. You cannot talk to him 10 minutes before he will tell you something about a cruise. Why? That's what he's passionate about. He loves that. Okay? As a teacher, do you ever find that you are so passionate about your classes that you talk about it. Someone was visiting our family one day, and understand that I teach all day. My wife, up until the last year, taught all day. My daughter teaches all day. And so on Sundays, we will get together and have lunch together, except on the Sundays I come down here. The other Sundays, we have lunch together. And my daughter has married a young man who is not a teacher. And so on Sunday, we get together, and we're talking about our classes and teaching. And one day, he sits there, and he, is that all you all know how to talk about? But it's what we love. It's what we enjoy. And so it's what we talk about. Do you have fun teaching? Do you enjoy it? Is it something that inspires you? I have often said that if you're a teacher, you should love teaching enough that you would do it for free. Now, the problem is this. I'm afraid my boss will hear that. And I can't afford to do it for free. So please don't go up to the college and tell the dean. He said he would do it for free because my dean would say, good. But do you have fun teaching? Do you find that you come to class early because you're just excited about what's going to happen? And do you enjoy preparing for class? Now, you can take that home. You can add it up. If you scored somewhere up there 30 to 40, you're still excited about teaching and you have enthusiasm. In the 20s, you're probably like an average teacher. And that is, yeah, you do it. And you're not a bad teacher, but maybe a bit of the excitement has worn off. If you're under 20, I have a friend who says, that means you're dead. They just haven't buried you yet. The reason I decided to start with this is this. We can't motivate our students if we're not motivated. If we are bored with the topic, the students will be bored with the topic, right? I had a science teacher in college who didn't like science. He did not enjoy the subject at all. He was very open about that. He had studied science, he knew it, and he got a job teaching, and then he found out that he really didn't enjoy it at all. And he was the most boring teacher that I ever had. The only class I can remember that I used every cut I was allowed, because I just didn't want to go if I didn't have to go. It was horrible. Do you think there was any chance of that science teacher motivating his students? Not at all. Because he wasn't motivated. He couldn't get us enthusiastic because he wasn't enthusiastic. If I'm going to motivate the students, if I'm going to make the horse thirsty, I've got to be excited. I talked to someone last week whose aunt is a piano teacher. And he said, my aunt loves teaching. She is 91 years old, and she still teaches 17 piano students every week. And he said, I asked her, how long are you going to do this? And she said, until I fall over dead, because this is what I love. This is what I want to do. Now, do you think it is likely that her 17 students are excited about learning the piano? Yeah, because they have a teacher who is excited about learning the piano. I've also seen teachers of piano who were probably somewhere in this 0 to 20 category of motivation, who had long since gotten bored with teaching, and they just kind of sat there, go ahead, play your piece. Yeah, you're supposed to play a C, not a D. Third finger, not fourth finger. Ugh. Next piece. Do you think their students ever got excited about learning the piano? No. Yeah. What had happened? The teacher had forgotten her enthusiasm or his enthusiasm, and now the students weren't motivated. So if I'm going to motivate them, I have to be motivated. But let's assume that you are motivated. Then we come to this law of motivation, and that says this. Teaching is most effective when the student is properly motivated. We're going to look at two terms there, motivated and proper. But before we do, I want you to take your paper and a pencil. I want you to think back to the best teacher you ever had in your life. Maybe in college, grade school, high school. Think of just a superb teacher that you still remember as a great teacher. And I want you to make a list of what they did that motivated you to want to be better. And when I think of the great best teacher, I'm thinking of the teacher that was the best at motivating you to want to excel. Okay, think of a teacher. I had teachers that I liked. They were nice people, but they didn't make me really want to work hard. I just, you know, they were nice people. But I can think, if I think of this, I think of a teacher who motivated me to the point where I would stay up all night and practice, not because I loved the piece, but because I wanted to please him. You know, he did a great job at motivating me to want to excel. So think of the teacher that was the best you know, you can remember, at helping you want to excel. And just jot down three or four things that they did that motivated you. Just take 2 minutes here to make your list. What did that teacher do that motivated you to want to do better? Just anywhere on your piece of paper. What did they do to motivate you? At least right now, you're not going to share the list. I just want you to jot it down, and then we will come back to it later, and you'll look at it. And if you can't think of a single teacher who ever motivated you to want to do well, that's very sad.
She was probably our math teacher, but she didn't remember. She told us about the geometry something. She was excited. I still can remember her eyes like lighten up. So that's, you know, till this day. I even forgot her name, everything, but I do remember the subject. Like, she just make me, oh, like I'm come alive. She was excited, even not her subject.
Good. Okay, good. All right, does everyone have your list? Just hold on to it for now. We're not going to discuss it yet. We will come back to it. But just keep that list with you. Now, weak teachers explain to their students. They talk to them. They use a lot of words. Good teachers demonstrate to their teachers, their students. They show them. Great teachers inspire the students to want to learn. I teach a class for piano teachers at the college. And I always, one of the assignments I give the students is sometime during, because all semester they have to teach and I watch them teach. I always assign them one lesson to pretend that they have laryngitis and can't talk. Because piano teachers all talk too much. We explain, we talk, do this, do this, do this, do this. But where is it that actually music happens in the piano? Playing, right? And so I say to the students, you have to do one lesson where you don't talk. You just play and show them. They do it, and then you show them how it can be better. They do it again, and you show them. Because you need to demonstrate. Don't just talk them to death. But even better, is a teacher who can inspire you to want to figure it out, to where you'll go do it yourself. They have poured salt into the oats. One of the best piano teachers I ever had was in France, and I didn't know French, and he didn't know very much English. And so we couldn't talk. He couldn't explain. He would demonstrate, but better than that, because he wasn't even always very good at demonstrating, because he had played so long, he was 90 years old, he had played so long that he had forgotten how to do these things. It just happened. But many, many times in a lesson, he would sit down and he would play something. And I would say, how did you do that? And he would, I never knew if he meant, I don't know how I did it, or I don't know what you said. But he would just, and I would leave and I would spend hours trying to make the sound he had made. What was he doing? Inspiring. Now, there are two ways that we go about motivation. And I want to look at this word properly. Because for many teachers, when I say teaching is most effective when the student is motivated, they think immediately of, can I give them candy? Can I do something to bribe them into being motivated? Okay? So I want to talk about proper motivation. Some motivators are what we call extrinsic. They come from outside. Okay, now, they're not always bad, but they do tend to be temporary. For instance, a lollipop. What is a lollipop? Candy, something sweet. Memorize 100 verses and we'll give you a trophy. Will that work? Sometimes. But eventually they have enough trophies to fill up their shelf. Right? And it quits working. I have a friend who is very, very good at teaching elementary choirs. Children just love this lady. Every time they come to choir rehearsal, she gives them candy. She makes homemade cookies and brings them in, and they just love her. There is a problem, though. She teaches elementary, she teaches junior high, and she teaches high school. Their school, she has a big elementary choir. Everyone wants to be in it because all the children want what? Candy and cookies. Junior high, it starts to drop off. And she has nobody. 1 year out of 50-some students, she had 3 in her choir in high school. Why? Because by high school, they have figured out it will be easier to buy my own candy than to go to choir practice, right? Yeah. Why stay an hour after school every day when I can just buy my own candy? It's not that expensive. She has relied entirely on lollipops, extrinsic buying. Now, again, is it always bad? No. Sometimes we need to do something to get them started, okay? But if that's all we use, do you see where it's going to run out pretty soon? Because at some point, someone will make them a better offer. Right? You offer them this, someone else will offer them more. Someone else will offer them more. Lollipops run out of having impact. Some motivators, some teachers try to use guilt as their motivator. The first teacher says, if you memorize 100 verses, I'm going to give you a trophy. And that's nice until they find out, someone was telling me, They went to someone's house, and the person had a really nice soccer trophy. I mean, a big one in their living room. And it was this great trophy. You know, I mean, it was beautiful. And so my friend went up to see the trophy and to read it. And there was nothing on it. The label was missing. And so he says to this person that has this nice soccer trophy, "How did you get this?" And he says, "Oh, I saw it at a yard sale. And I thought it would look nice in my living room, so I bought it." I heard that story and I thought, yeah, that's what can happen, right? Eventually, it loses its meaning. The judge, the teacher who uses guilt, says, "Now, people, if you don't memorize the Bible, you're not a very good Christian. If you really loved God, you would memorize." Okay? Since I'm a piano teacher, the first one is, if you practice 5 days, I will give you some candy or I'll give you a little sticker or whatever. Does that work with children? Yeah. But I have the mother of one of my students in the room today. And a high school student, I can tell you, doesn't care whether he gets the little sticker. Right? It just doesn't matter. And I teach mostly college students, and I can tell you the college students don't even want the sticker. Okay? That's going to run out. Guilt. Your parents have sacrificed, and I've used it, I confess. Your parents have sacrificed for you to have piano lessons. They've missed meals because they couldn't afford your lessons and food. There are children starving who would give anything for the privilege of just one piano lesson. How can you not practice? Does it work? Yeah, it will work for a week or two. But eventually, our Sunday school students learn that, you know what, there's a whole bunch of Christians who don't memorize Bible verses. Right? The guilt wears off. The student realizes, you know what, I bet my mom never did go hungry for my lessons. And maybe the worst. Y'all know Pinocchio, right? I've heard this a lot, and we mean well, but it's not right. If you memorize the Bible, you will always have victory over temptation. Because when temptation comes, you quote the Bible, and the devil will run. Is that true? Sometimes. Sometimes. But sometimes in temptation. Pardon? Sometimes we quote the Bible, but the temptation is still real. I've heard chapel speakers come to our college. Young people, if you will give your life to Christ, if you will live your life for God, your life is going to be wonderful. It will be full of blessings, and God is going to make your life wonderful. Is that true? Sometimes. But sometimes, I have known people who gave their life to God. They have served Him faithfully, and they have suffered terrible, terrible tragedies. And so, none of these, it seems to me, really is an effective, good motivation. Will they work for a while? Sometimes. But they run out. The other kind of motivators are what we call intrinsic. That is, they come from inside. They don't rely on candy. Now, again, I think sometimes there is help to get someone started. A little child, if giving them a lollipop will get them to practice, I'll do it. I want to get them started. Because I have to get them on the right path to keep them, to get them going. But that's not going to continue it, okay? When you're teaching a kindergartner, yeah, I'll give you, you know, whatever award or treat, whatever for memorizing, that's fine. But sometime we have to go beyond that. So, here are some intrinsic motivators. Ownership. Any of you collect stamps or coins? Okay. Why do you collect stamps? I mean, they've already been used, right? So they're worthless.
Some stamps are, even if it's used, it is more valuable. I
mean, that's
it's because
true.
It's collector's.
Okay,
item.
So are you expecting to become rich from your stamps?
I was hoping to bank on that for retirement.
How is it going? How's it going?
I'm not sure how it's going.
Why do you collect stamps?
That's a good question.
Let me guess that it's not because you're getting
an
award.
Not.
It's not because you feel guilty if you don't.
It's not.
And someone, it sounds like maybe someone told you a lie and told you you could retire if you collected them.
Yeah.
Okay, so maybe that's the one. But let's hope not. Why do you collect stamps?
Somehow it's like something that you gather, you hunt, other people don't have. Right? It's something that I have and other people don't have.
Ownership.
Yeah.
It's yours. Right?
Yeah.
I have this. No one may ever even come to see your stamps. But you know those are mine. Right? When we give students ownership, it matters. We just finished doing a musical with our music students up at the college. If you get tired of hearing about my students, I'm sorry, but that's the only ones I can use as examples. Okay, we did a musical for 10 weeks. These kids spent 10 to 15 hours a week in practice. So they spent 100 to 150 hours practicing, rehearsing. Then they built their own sets, made their own costumes. Some of them spent all night some nights working on the sets, missed classes in order to keep sewing, you know, guys who had never touched a piece of cloth before, you know, sewing, were in the room sewing their own costumes. They don't get any credit for this. They don't get any money for this. And they worked themselves to death to make this happen. The last week, those poor kids were in that room almost around the clock getting ready for this. Why? It is theirs. The poster says Hope Sound Bible College Music Department. It's theirs. It belongs to them. We don't do it as teachers. I didn't make a single costume. I didn't make the set because if I did, you wouldn't want to see it. All I did was say, if you want to do it, you can do it. And when it's done, it's not mine. It's yours. When kids would come and say, do we have to do such and such for the costumes? I would say, doesn't matter to me. If y'all walk out there without any costumes at all, it's your musical. You know, you can walk out there looking like this, but it's yours. Well, no, we want people to be impressed. Well, then, you better figure out how to impress them. Do you think this set is okay? And I'd look at it and, well, it's your musical. Are you happy with it? No, I think it needs this. Well, here's a hammer. It was theirs. And when it was done, they're proud of it. It belongs to them. And when it was done, the next day, three of the kids came to my office. Can we do this next year? I said, you've been grumbling for a week about losing sleep. You're tired. You've been unhappy all. Oh, but this is wonderful. We love it. Can we please do this again next year? I said, I don't know, because I'm tired. But do you understand ownership? Now, let me ask you this. In your Sunday school classes, whose class is it? Yours or theirs? Should be theirs. Do the kids feel like this is my class and I want it to be a good one? You see, if we can give them that sense of ownership, do you see what that'll do? If you teach the adults, if we can get the adults to feel like this is my class, we want this to be a great class. We want people to be wanting to come to this because of how wonderful this class. Now they're willing to pour themselves into it. There's really no great reason for them to work hard outside of class so that you'll look good as a teacher. I mean, what difference does it make to them if you look good, right? But if it's their class, and their class is going to be a good one because of what they did, do you see that? That matters. And that kind of motivation carries on. Curiosity is a great motivator. Some people collect stamps because they've always wondered what the stamps look like from other countries. When they see a stamp, I wonder what that country's like. And they go and look it up online. You know, they want to find something about it. Curiosity. I always think about people who travel for fun. For me, travel is about doing something when I get there. But the travel itself, I really don't enjoy at all. You know, it's just hard. Planes are uncomfortable. The food in planes is not good. The beds are usually not as comfortable as my bed. You know, all of this. And I think about people who willingly travel a lot. Why do they do it? One reason is curiosity. They want to see what it's like in Egypt. What is it like in China? What's it like in India? Curiosity. On occasion, I will have a piano student, and I'll play a piece, and I'll kind of, you know, do part of it, and then I'll stop right at a kind of a key part. Well, what's next? Well, I can't tell you till you learn the first part. Now, for some of them, they're smart enough, they'll go to YouTube and find it out, and it doesn't work. But for some of them, that curiosity, I want to know what's next. And it builds interest. Need is a great motivator. I graduated from graduate school, degree in piano. And then I had a job that did not require me to play the piano. And while everyone thinks that if you're a pianist, that's probably just the thing that you do for fun all the time, the fact is I went 2 years, I never touched a piano. I had a piano in my house. I shut the lid one day, and 2 years later, I realized I had never opened the lid. I didn't have to do it for my job, and so it didn't matter. And then they called me and asked me to come to Hobe Sound and teach piano. All of a sudden, practice became the center of my life. Why? Need. It really wasn't about a lollipop, because they don't pay me that much. It wasn't really about guilt, because I didn't have to take the job. And they didn't lie to me. It was, I needed to practice. Because all of a sudden, I was going to have students that they had not spent 2 years not practicing. And if they were better than me, it was going to be really uncomfortable. Suddenly, need became a great motivator. Do your students ever in your Sunday school class get a feeling, I need this? This is what I need in my life. Whether it's an adult who realizes, hey, the challenge, the problem I'm having in my marriage, this book of the Bible has the answer. And I need it. Because if I get that, it's going to help me. Isn't that a great motivator? When you realize this book has the answer? You were talking about Martin the Cobbler.
Yes.
If a child can get a sense, the Bible, these lessons, they have something practical to help me. Now they need them. Now they want to learn. Challenge is a great motivator. To set a goal, something that students have to reach for, that they have to stretch for. And we challenge them. Can you get there? Very often our freshmen at Hope Sound that come as a piano major, they come and they want to major in music for one reason, and that is they don't know what else to do. But they've heard some music that they liked, and so, you know, that's it. And the chances of them working hard enough to prepare a whole recital and graduate is really slim. They don't have a motivation. Very often, I remember one of our students who came, and she just, you know, wasn't motivated at all. Her freshman year, she wasn't passing. She wasn't even going to end up, you know, coming back. And one day we were talking, and I realized the kind of music she liked. And so I went home, and I found me a copy of Rhapsody in Blue. Those of you who know piano know Rhapsody in Blue is kind of this jazzy piece of music. And it's exciting, and it's fun, and it's wonderful. So at her next lesson, when she got to her lesson, I was already playing the piano, and I was practicing this piece, playing this piece. And she comes out, I said, come on in. And I'm sitting playing, and she loved this piece. And she said, can I learn this? I said, no, you're not good enough. Well, that's, you know, not what you're supposed to say. And I kept playing, and she said, no, really, this is neat. I said, yeah, but you're not good enough, and you don't work hard enough. You'll never learn this. I keep playing, get to the really exciting spot. And she said, what do I have to do to learn this? And I knew, this is going to work. I said, I tell you what, here are the steps. And if you will do this on your senior recital, this will be your main piece. For 4 years, she practiced, and she's now a wonderful piano teacher. You know, she went on, she got a master's degree and has done a great, you know, job. But she needed a challenge. For her, there had never been, and I hadn't done it myself, I had never given her something that caused her to say, this is worth working for. If you want your students to be motivated, challenge them. And then for some students, recognition, approval. You know, it struck me one day, for most students, now this isn't true for all of the students, but for most students, what is it that is their number one goal when they come to class? For most of your young students, what is their number one goal in class? Let me help you here. Is it to learn something? Okay, sometimes it's to be with their friends. Sometimes it's usually not to learn something. You know what I think for many of them their number one goal is? They want to make you happy. They want a teacher who is happy with what they're doing. And yet so many times we never show them that we're happy with what they want recognition. Even, in fact, I think especially, that young boy who is sitting there, and when you start talking, he starts hitting the person next to him. What does he want from you? Attention. He would rather have negative attention than no attention, right? Now, if he sits there and listens the whole class, what are you going to say to him? Probably nothing, because he didn't do anything. But as soon as he starts tying the girl in front of him, tying her hair into a knot, What are you going to do? Michael? Stop that. That's rude. What did Michael hear? Michael. Okay? Like a dog, you know. Emmy, blah, little, 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 little. They don't know anything except they heard their name. Right? Michael wants to hear his name. Now think about that for a minute. What if Michael gets that kind of recognition and approval? And you say, well, it wasn't approval. In his ear, he heard his name. What if he gets that? For doing good. For being there. Now he has that kind of approval as a positive motivation. I remember in school, and this is a terrible thing to say, but in especially second, third, fourth grade, I was the only person in the class who had glasses. My dad was a preacher, the only person in the class whose dad was a preacher. I was never athletic. I couldn't run to, you know, races. I couldn't do anything. And I got in a lot of trouble in second and third grade because if I did something that caused trouble, I got the approval of my classmates, right? And I got the attention of my teacher. And so the teacher goes out the door one day, and I run back and take the screwdriver and unscrew the doorknob so that when she walks in the door and pulls the door, it all falls in the floor. And she walks in, and what was the first thing she said? She said, Randy McElwain, I know you did that. You know what that did for me? Out of this whole class, she knows I'm the only one that would do that. You understand? Did that feel pretty good? Yeah, I got a spanking, that's true. But I also got the recognition of knowing out of 30 students, she knows if someone takes the doorknob off the door, that's me. Yeah, that's my work. I had ownership. You understand? Now, in our classes, it seems to me we have to somehow find these things for our students. I have a little boy. He's a piano student, but he's in Taekwondo. Anybody know about Taekwondo? They have belts. You know, he comes to his lesson after his Taekwondo, and he has a yellow belt, and then he comes and he has an orange belt, you know. And one day I said, Adam, I want to ask you about your belts. Okay, I said, what are they worth? I don't know. I said, what do you have to do to get one? So he tells me, you know, they have to do this and this and this. And I said, and then what? Well, then I get another belt. Okay, then what? A different color, exactly. And he has memorized all of the colors all the way up to black. You know, he's got it all figured out. And I'm sitting there and I thought, you know what? When he finishes Clemente Sonnantino 1, what is next? Clemente Sonnantino 2. Followed by a Kuhlau Sonnantino. Followed by a Mozart Sonata movement. If somehow I can give him the kind of recognition and approval he gets from just standing there kicking, and, you know, doing whatever he does, I have to find how to motivate. So, let's think in terms of your classes. What are some concrete, practical ways that you can give your classes ownership? Or let me backtrack. Which is easier for you as a teacher, this list or that list? This one is easy, isn't it? I mean, it it would cost me $20. I can stop at Dunkin' Donuts on the way here and give every one of you a donut if you answer a question during class, right?
Yes.
And $20 isn't that bad. That's easy. I can probably come up with a way of making you feel like complete failures if you don't show up next time. Your students will never really learn. They'll never get a hold of the Bible. Some of them will leave the church because you did not teach well. You know, that's easy, right? All I have to do is go find a television evangelist, copy down his sermon, and come read it to you. Right? I can lie to you. If you teach well, every single one of your students is going to end up on the mission field, is going to be a preacher, is going to be an evangelist. Okay? And I can lie to you of the importance of what you're doing. These are fairly easy.
No sweat.
This is hard. You see, next week I won't be here. And so if it's not your class, there's no reason whatsoever for you to pay a bit of attention to what I said today. Because it's not mine. And if you don't have any ownership of this, why should you go to the trouble? Right? So these are hard. These are why they're paying you so much to be a Sunday school teacher. Some of you caught on. Some of you are still working through that one. But this is hard work. But do you understand this is what will last? This is what will make a difference in your student? So can you give me an idea of how to create ownership? Yes. Okay.
I want to select the leader of my class and ask him, if you are the teacher, how are you going to lead the class?
Okay, good.
He's going to give me some idea.
All right.
We can practice.
Very good. One of the things I do in my...
You can do it in turn. Yeah.
Yeah, that's good.
You own this.
Okay. In my freshman Bible class, I started, and I did not do it for the sake of getting them to learn their subject better. I did it because one of our goals as a Bible college is our graduates are supposed to leave and teach Sunday school, pastor, be missionaries. And so I wanted to make sure that somehow I was connecting what they were studying with what they were going to do. And so I started for the freshmen the last 2 weeks of the class. Every student is responsible to take one book of the Bible and teach it in 8 minutes to some audience. So if they are a ministerial major, they preach an 8-minute sermon from one of the books of the Bible. If they're an education major, they teach a Sunday school class. You know, everyone does something. You know what I found? On the final exams, the student who chooses Jude as his book never ever misses a question on the final exam about Jude. Why? Yeah, actually, it being a short book is a good reason they often miss it, because it doesn't seem important. But to the student who taught it, that's his book. He needs to know it because he has to teach it. And when he's done, the students are either sitting there going, that was boring, or, wow, that was great. So he's getting recognition and approval. And the student who teaches Jude never misses a question on the final exam about Jude. The student who says, I'll do the book of Acts, never misses a question about the book of Acts. I didn't do it for the sake of their learning. I did it for the practical experience. But the fact is, they learn it a whole lot better because it belongs to them. It's theirs, and there's a challenge. There's a need. They get approval. They learn. Okay, very good. Someone else. What's a way to build curiosity for your subject? You know, our young lady here with the guitar, do you play the guitar? A little bit. Would you do me a favor? Do you know the chords? Not really. Okay, that's okay. I don't know either. But let me tell you something. If she goes, do you take guitar lessons? Okay. If she goes to her guitar lesson and her teacher plays one chord, four chord, five chord, and stops, she will go home and learn how to find a one chord. Because for those of you who aren't musicians, here's what happens. And it is very miserable not to finish that. Right? I mean, that has to be finished. Okay, that's all. You can go. Thank you. You understand? If I can give them, they have to finish it. There, you can't just leave that chord there. And then now some of you, the musicians in the room, are going to be miserable the rest of the class because I didn't finish it. But you understand? If I can somehow build in the student a curiosity, a need to finish it, they'll learn it for themselves. I was going to have you demonstrate it on guitar if you knew those chords on guitar. Next time you will. Thank you. It's dangerous to be in the room where I teach.
Can I ask a question? The curiosity, is that some students naturally have more curiosity or just not? You know, the two boys you teach them, you know, very different. Joshua always have a great curiosity. Daniel seems, you know, so how can you inspire them?
Now, very good question. Some students are naturally more curious. Right. The truth of the matter is, I have some students that if I do that, they would say, it's okay, I don't mind. Maybe there's supposed to be a chord after that, but it doesn't really matter to me. Okay? I think there's two answers. One is, well, let me ask you this. Will every one of these work for every student?
No.
And so for some students, curiosity is not going to be the key. For some students, it's going to be recognition and approval. For some students, recognition and approval is going to be counterproductive because they'll be embarrassed.
Yes.
I have two children. My son, if a teacher showed recognition to him, he would do anything for that teacher. You know, he wants approval. He wants recognition. My daughter, if there was public recognition, would probably never do it again because she doesn't want recognition. Last night, we played on a piano concert up at the college, Stacy and I. She worked very, very hard out of the challenge because she loves a challenge, out of ownership because it was her and I on the piece, and it was our piece. But when at the end they made us come back out to bow, she said, can we leave now? She didn't want recognition, okay? What she wanted, and the fact is for her, if she did well and they didn't like it, not going to matter to her a bit because she did well. On the other hand, if she didn't do well and they all said that was the greatest thing in the world, all she thinks is, wow, they sure don't know much about music, okay? So part of it is that. And there is where, as a teacher, you have to be sensitive to every student. My student who Rhapsody in Blue was the key, God had helped me to understand with her that she needed a challenge And if I could find the right challenge, she would jump for it. My little Adam, he isn't motivated by a challenge, but he really, really wants approval. He's the one that collects all of the Taekwondo belts, okay? He came in one day, and he hadn't practiced all week. He just hadn't done well at all. Every piece was bad. I said, Adam, next week I'm going to give you a belt in piano. Really? I said, yes, it's going to be pink.
Aww.
I don't want a pink belt. I said, well, you know, pink belts in piano go to the men who don't practice. What do I have to do not to get a pink belt? He came back the next week. I love little Adam. He's a great. He said, every piece is perfect. I said, really?
He
said,
no, yep,
perfect. I said, all right, no pink belts. If I brag on him, wonderful. I have other students who they really don't care if I brag on them or not. It doesn't matter to them. Okay. So every student is going to be different. You have to find what is the key to this. But do you understand that's why I say this is a toolbox that you need ideas for every one of them. You see, if you call someone to your house to work on your house, and he comes in and he has a toolbox of hammers, and you have a broken window that you need fixed, is he going to help you any? No. And you call him in and you say, I have a broken window, I need this fixed. And he says, okay, here's my hammer. And you say, I've already used a hammer. That's why it's broken. Well, I have a bigger hammer. No. But there are teachers who they are really good on one of these. They have one thing in their toolbox. Now, they are very successful at every student who needs that thing. If you need a hammer, they are your man. Okay? But they don't reach the other students. I have a friend who is a teacher who is, she is worlds ahead of me on this whole thing of recognition and approval, because I'm not good at that. I really am not good at showing recognition and approval. Partly because I don't respond to it very well myself. My teachers, my piano teachers, were not approval teachers. You know, the best teacher I ever had, a piano teacher, the best compliment he ever gave me one day, he said, well, that isn't nearly as bad as it was last time. And that was, you know, I mean, that was way up here. Because usually when I got done, he would say, there are seven things that are horrible about this performance, and then he would list them. And the next time I would play it, and he would not say anything about those seven things. He would say, there are seven things that are horrible, and it was a different list. You know, I couldn't win. But he was a great teacher, and so it was okay. So I'm not good at recognition and approval. I have a friend who is wonderful at recognition and approval. Her kids, she may have a student who couldn't play Twinkle Twinkle Little Stars for save her life, and that student will think that they are the next Horowitz. You know, she just is wonderful at motivating them and making them feel good. However, that's all. That's her only tool. And she loses her students. She loses her students if they reach a point where they need a challenge, because she doesn't know how to challenge them. You see? So you have to have all of these tools, because you're right. You'll have one student who is very curious, and all you have to say to him is, you know, I wonder how old Mozart was when he died. And you don't have to tell them. What are they going to do? They're going to go look it up, and the next lesson they're going to come back and say, he died in 1791. He was 35 years old. And did you know that they buried him in a grave without a marker because he was too poor to have his own grave? Did you know that, Dr. McElwain? And you look at him, well, no, I never heard of that. That's amazing. Curiosity will do that, student. But another student, if you say, I wonder how old Mozart was when he died, they'll say, I don't know. Ed, I don't care. Doesn't really matter. All I know is he must be dead because you said he was. So who cares if he's dead? What difference does it make? You have to have all of these. Someone give me a way to build curiosity in your class.
Can I have a question, just a sidetrack a little bit? Does the student, according to your observation, does the student change when they grow older, or there are some main things like stick with them, like curiosity or challenge? So how can you like adjust just something like that? Do they have their main character like something they're not going to change?
I think to some degree, probably some of these aspects of personality will stick with them forever. You know, the person who is motivated by approval, probably when they're 40 years old, by now they know not to admit it, but when their boss at work says, you know, you're the best engineer we've ever had, that feels good. Okay? So to some degree it will stay. However, I also think that through our life, at different points, different things become a motivator. I will probably never be terribly motivated by recognition and approval. If I know I played badly and you tell me it was great, it doesn't make me feel very good because I know it was bad. Okay? I will always be motivated by challenge. If someone says, I don't think it's possible to do this, I really, really will want to find out if there's a way to do it. But at different points, need has been a great motivator. Let me give you an example. I do not enjoy books on leadership. Okay, that's an area that just has never interested me to read about at all. But 10 years ago, 11 years ago, I guess now, the president at Hope Sound asked me if I would be principal of the academy. And part of my job there was to motivate the teachers, to guide, lead the direction. And suddenly, guess what I was spending hours doing every week? Reading every book on leadership I could find, calling people who liked these kind of books and saying, what's the next book I need to read? And suddenly I had on my shelf, you know, a shelf this long of books that 6 months before I wouldn't have given you 10 cents for the whole shelf. And now I was going out buying them at $25 a volume. Okay? Why? Need. Suddenly I needed that. Okay? So to some degree the motivation will change, but I think at the root, probably every one of our students has something that for them, this is the key. And if you can find that key, you open up for them a whole new world. Curiosity, for your class, any ideas, any suggestions? How do you build curiosity for your students?
Today with my middle school class, but I only got their attention for 5 minutes. It's not very successful. What I said is, do you know 80% of youth grow up in the church, drop out of Jesus Christ at the end?
Okay.
Go to the eternal death. And they're very curious about that, but after 5 minutes, they want to play video game again, I guess.
Okay. All right. All right. Now, it sounds like you made a great start because you got their attention for 5 minutes. They're junior high, right? What age? Middle school. Yeah. Okay. 5 minutes in middle school is the equivalent of 3 hours in adult age. Okay. So.
First answer I give them is because they did not pay attention to Sunday class. They laugh. It's not that.
Okay. This one? Guilt? Guilt. Now, I would say you made a great start with that. You connected for 5 minutes, they're listening. Now, here is the challenge with teaching. All of these will work sometime. None of them will work all the time. Again, we're back to a toolbox. I just told you a workman who comes to your house with a toolbox of hammers may not be able to fix your problem, right? But does that mean that then hammers are not a good tool to have? No, because it might be exactly what is needed for some jobs. The key, it seems to me, is having curiosity and then moving from that to the next step before we lose them, okay? If you were able to grab their curiosity with the fact that 80% of junior, what'd you say?
Say that again.
80% of youth in the church leave Christianity as an adult, right? Is there a way to move that from curiosity to ownership? That means that 80% of their friends, not just everybody, look around you. According to that statistic, in this room of 10 students, 10 to 12 students, 8 to 9 of you will leave the church, will leave Christianity. Now, if you're one of the three that wants to live your life for God, how can you help the person on beside you who, according to what I just told you, is likely to leave? What can I do as a teacher that will keep them? I'm going to assume that I'm keeping you. But what about your neighbor? What can I do for them? Now, whose problem is this? Their problem. It's not your problem now, it's their problem. Because it is their friend that we have to somehow keep in the church. Once I have their ownership of this problem, now they start to dig into it. Will any of them come up with some good suggestions? Hopefully. Hopefully they'll come up with something. Yeah. Now I can give them recognition and approval. That might work. Okay? And when you say to them, that might work, now you've recognized them. You've validated their idea. You understand? So you're working through all of these. I think what you said was a great example of curiosity. If from that you can open up need, recognition, you're moving with them, and you're keeping them involved. Because what happens sometimes is we start and we lose them and we give up instead of finding a way to continue. But that was a great way to do curiosity. Any ideas on need? How can you create need in your students for what you teach? You teach upper elementary, and what subject are you teaching right now?
I was just a speaker for the Sunday, for the Sunday for Easter, but my next teaching will be in June, so I don't have any classes now.
Okay, do you know what your topic will be in June?
No, I haven't got a curriculum yet. Okay. I get the Bible study, the challenge.
Okay.
Bible studies.
What was Easter?
Easter
was, well, the Easter story. Okay.
Yes, the Easter story.
Yeah. Is there a way to help out elementary students to understand that they need this? And I think actually the story you told them did that. Your story about forgiveness and broken windows shows we need what Jesus did at Easter. We need that. A way to challenge, you teach what grade?
Adults.
How do you challenge them? Because I think for adults, probably challenge is more important than recognition and approval. By the way, very often for middle school and up, especially middle school and adults, high school not so much, but middle school and adults, recognition and approval, if you're not very careful, is counterproductive. It embarrasses them. In fact, very often, if even in the college, if I want to brag on a student, I will go to them privately and say, you know, that comment was really, really good. That was helpful. Because if I say that in class, exactly, their classmates are going to say, teacher's pet, you know, and I'll lose them.
I find curiosity for my younger ones, it works. And many times, like I said, during the week, I look for something that will perk their interest.
Good.
Especially other kids doing it, and they can relate.
Good.
Rather than, yeah, so I always have to look for something that I know will pique their interest.
Good, good. How do you create a challenge for your adult class?
That's my challenge.
That is your challenge.
Because they are old enough that they have faced so many challenges in their life. Nothing. They are just unfazed. I said, okay, I challenge you that now we learn this book in the Bible, and then find something that you can do this week, or just find something that you learned today that share with your family this evening.
Okay. Let me say, let's go to this, and this may be where we finish today. Out of this list, and this is going to what you just said, because it's difficult with adults. Out of this list, which of those do you think is the most effective motivator most of the time? Finish the sentence. Oh, it's on your handout. I'm sorry. I should have left that blank. Yeah, sorry. I should have left that. For most of us, the most effective, most powerful motivator over long term is need. Because once we need it, we're going to do it. Give you a couple examples. At the college, we send our ministerial majors and our music majors out on the weekends to go to churches. Ministerial majors will go somewhere and preach. Music majors will go somewhere and do music. On Monday, they come back. If a ministerial major who is taking a class on how to preach, if he gets up on Sunday and he was supposed to preach a 20-minute sermon, and after 7 minutes, he had run out of things to say and is going, and this is a very good verse, and I hope that you will remember it forever and ever. Amen. Goodbye. Do you think on Monday he will pay more attention to his class on preaching?
Yep.
Yeah. Why?
He
has a need now. He got up. He thought he had it whipped. He got up in front of everyone and found out, I need to know a lot more about how to preach. Right? When a piano student comes back after playing for a church on Sunday, and they say, Dr. McElwain, they sang a song and I didn't know how to play it. Now there is need. The most effective motivator, it seems to me, for long term, is need. I think I told you before about my teacher, Tony, when I was principal at a school in Missouri who got punched in the nose by a student. I told you about that, right? Until he got punched in the nose, not one thing I ever told him about improving his teaching ever mattered. He would sit in faculty meetings, and I would be trying to go through this stuff with them, you know, and I would be pouring my heart out, and he's sitting there grading papers because Tony knew far more than I would know about teaching. I would talk to him about discipline, and I could just see he's thinking, when is he going to get done? Because I've got stuff to do. But after that person punched him in the nose, suddenly, when I would talk to Tony about discipline, he's writing it down. You know, he's asking questions. Now, how do I do that in my class? Do you think you could come in and watch my class and see if it's working, is effective? Suddenly in faculty meetings, he was on the front row, and when I got done, he's got a question. Why? Because he'd been punched in the nose. And suddenly he needed to know about classroom management and discipline. Right? And I think I told you he became the principal after I left. Because in 2 years, he had learned a whole bunch of stuff about discipline. And the motivator was need. Now, you know why our adult Sunday school students are not challenged to work harder to learn the stuff in Sunday school for their lesson? They would never admit this, but the truth is they don't think they need it. Right? The Bible is a great book. They know that. And it's very interesting. They're glad that someone wrote it. But the truth is, when they think about their daily problems and their daily life, they don't think that this book is probably going to solve any of those problems. So they don't need it. Would you agree? Most people in most churches, when they bump into a problem on Tuesday morning in their life, it never crosses their mind to look here for an answer. Why? Because they've never found any answers. Now, they found out how to get saved, so that was nice, but they've already been saved. And now what are they doing? Waiting to go to heaven. Right? And between getting saved, which this was really useful then, and getting to heaven, the rest of the time, this might as well just be on the shelf somewhere because it has no practical use in their life. Right? But that couple that is on the verge of a divorce because their marriage is falling apart, or they're not going to divorce because they know they're not supposed to, so they're just going to live together miserable the rest of their life. That couple, if we can show them that this could not just keep them from a divorce, but could actually help them to fall in love with each other again, do you think suddenly they'd want to read this?
Yes.
Yeah. Those parents that have decided the only thing you can do with children is once they turn 5, nail them in a box, and then open the box on their 18th birthday and send them to college because there's no hope for them. There's just no way in the world you can control them. If somehow they understood that that book helps us to understand how to handle our children, do you think suddenly they would want to read it for their Sunday school class? That worker who goes to work 40 hours a week at a job that he absolutely hates. It has no meaning whatsoever. It is just empty. But it's either that or starve to death. And he's thought about it, and it's really a close call. But he's decided that the job is just slightly better than starving to death. So he keeps doing it. If somehow he understood that in Ecclesiastes you get a picture of a purpose for life that is bigger than your job, you think suddenly he would want to read Ecclesiastes?
Yes.
Yeah. The key, it seems to me, is we have to give them, and especially at the adult level, no, not just because it's true at middle school too, we have to give them a need. You did a great start with that. 80% of their classmates will probably leave the church That's a shocking fact. Now, if somehow you can connect that to the need that we are responsible for those around us, how can we change that? Suddenly, they want to learn. Because now this has the answer to things that they desperately, desperately need. It seems to me that we have to do four things. The simplest step in teaching is the telling stage. That's unfortunately where many of us stop. Right? I once went to a graduate class in which the teacher gave us a lecture on how to tell a story to a class. Okay. But did you catch what I said? He gave us a what? Lecture on how to tell a story. You know what? He didn't do the entire 55 minutes tell any stories. All he did was tell. Very often we stop there. Sometimes we show. We tell a story. We give a story and suddenly we understand this is how to tell a story. Fred Craddock was, he's dead now, I believe, but he was one of the greatest teachers of how to preach. There were days in his class where he never gave a single PowerPoint or step. Instead, the students would walk in. One day he was teaching, and he was teaching on Romans 16. Now, if you know Romans, Romans 16 is the chapter with all the names. The students walked into class that day, and Dr. Craddock said, "We are going to study Romans 16. And he read it to them, this list of names. And then Dr. Craddock said, "In my first church, there was a man by the name of Fred. Fred couldn't read. Fred was completely illiterate. But I met Fred out one day farming. And I realized Fred is never going to come to my church because you have to wear a suit. Because I wear a suit." And so he said, "The next week, I went to the store and I bought me a pair of overalls. And I went out to see Fred." And he said, I asked him if I could help him with his cows. And he said, "I got kicked by one of the cows." And he told the story of getting kicked by the cow. But about 6 months later, Fred started coming to our church. And Fred became an elder in our church. Verse 2. And he read verse 2. And he told a story of someone in his church. He read verse 3. And he told a story of someone in his church that would give and serve and help others. He went through, and the entire class, all he did was tell stories. And when he was done, he said, "Class is dismissed." I have never, since that day, read Romans 16 without understanding that Romans 16 is about real people with real problems, real potential, that are transformed if they meet the gospel. Because all of Romans is about how we are made right with God. And then at the end of Romans, we have a whole list of people who one day were wrong with God. And because of the power of the gospel, they were turned around and made right with God. And now their names in this book. But Fred Craddock didn't ever tell me that. All he did was tell a bunch of stories. And those stories showed me what Romans 16 is about. You understand? showing is far more powerful than telling. But we need to go beyond that if we're going to create a need. Because when I tell them, they say, oh, that's really nice. When I show them, they say, oh, I wish I could tell stories that way. But then if I can send them out to do it in a controlled setting. Now, by a controlled setting, I mean among friends, among people who will like what they do. In my class, I have the students teach, I told you. And who's the students? They're classmates. So their classmates are going to be supportive. It's controlled. And when they're done, I can say to them, you know, you had 8 minutes to teach the book of Acts. You spent 7.5 minutes on verse 1. Probably you're not going to get all the way through. Let's look at how you do an overview. Okay, so I can help them in a controlled setting. But the next step in creating a need is real life. This is where I send my students to the academy, and they're going to be a teacher, and I say, go teach a Bible class to the kindergartners. Oh, yeah, I can do that. You know, I'm in college. I know how to teach kindergarten. They're little kids. I can do this. And they go and they come back. How did it go? Those kids wouldn't even sit there long enough to listen to me. Oh, really? You mean they're normal? Oh. So you're not going to ever be able to teach the normal kids. Is that what you're saying? Oh, what can I do about it? Now we have a need, right? Howard Hendricks said, the U.S. government will give 19-year-olds a multi-million-dollar airplane and let them fly it. But we won't trust a 19-year-old with the Sunday school offering in the church. You understand what he's saying? Let's let them do it. Let's put them out there and get them involved. How many of you have had Jehovah Witness come to your door and knock on your door? How many of you opened the door? Are you okay? How many of them are there when they come to your door? There's always two. Now, here's what I want you to understand. There's always two. One of them is experienced, and the other is the learner. Okay? When they talked to you, which one did the talking? The learner does the talking. When they leave your house, if they did a lousy job, you'll see them go back to the car and they sit there and they talk for a half hour. And the experienced one is telling the learner what he did wrong. Now they go to the next door. Now, if you have helped out your neighbor, you've already called them and said, don't answer the door when they knock. But if you didn't tell them that, they knock. They open. Guess which one talks? The learner again. After he just did a lousy job of it at your house, he gets to do it again. Why? That's how we build a need. That's how we learn. And when that learner goes back to that car to sit down, do you think he listens to the trainer? Absolutely, because I just got embarrassed. I didn't have an answer to that question. And I don't want that to happen again. You see what we do? Now, that's what we have to do with our students. We have to give them the opportunity to do it. And to realize the need. Now, here's your homework assignment. I'm out of time. I want you to, each one of you, to think about your students this week. I want you to make a list of the top three needs in the lives of the students in your class. So, upper elementary, middle school, adults, whatever. What you think their biggest concerns are. In other words, for my middle school students, what are the three things I think they are most worried about in life? Then, next week, give them a survey in class. anonymous, have them write down, what are the things that are most important in my life? What are my biggest concerns? And then match them. If I pretty well nailed down their three, then that means I probably know these kids. If I said their three main concerns were video games, and they give three things that are far different, then that means I need to spend some time figuring out what are their needs. And then, what am I going to do in the next month to make my teaching match their needs? Because if I am teaching, I may be doing a great job of teaching as far as giving information. But if it doesn't fit any of their needs, it's not going to work. Okay? If I had come here today, I hope I connected with your needs as teachers, because you're teachers. If I come here today with a great lecture on cooking rice, it might be a great lecture, but would it do any good? No, because y'all don't need it. You're experts. You don't need me to tell you how to cook rice. Right?
Just put in the rice cooker.
Okay. But sometimes we do a great job of teaching stuff they don't know they need. We've got to connect with their needs. All right. Thank you. Let's pray. Dear God, thank you for our students that you have given to us. Thank you for these teachers who give up their Sunday afternoon to learn more about teaching. Would you bless them for their sacrifice? Would you encourage them? Would you give them your special help? And then would you bring them back to their classrooms and give them the ability to connect with their students, to touch their students? Our brother reminded us of how many of our students grow up and leave the church and never come back. Would you help us as teachers to be able to turn that around to where we can connect with these young people, that will give them a passion for you, a love for you, that we won't lose any of them. Yes, that we'll see them fall in love with you to where when they leave here, they will love you and they will want to live their life for you, not out of fear, not out of guilt, but out of a deep, deep love for you. I pray in Jesus' name. Amen.